Hello, and welcome to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, November 19th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. Let's start with the weather forecast for today. Today should be partly sunny, windy, and warmer, with winds from 15 to 25 miles per hour and a high of 51 degrees. Tonight, there should be considerable cloudiness, winds from 7 to 14 miles per hour and a low of 27 degrees. And now these local headlines. Infrastructure future. Dolly A. Butch reports from Sioux City. Mayor Bob Scott hopes some of the projects the city hasn't had the money to tackle in the past will become a reality after President Joe Biden signed the $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill into law on Monday. We've got problem areas that we just need to address. This would really help us if we do get an allocation rather than a grant-only type deal, Scott said. Iowa will receive roughly $5 billion over 5 years in new federal funding for infrastructure projects such as roads and bridges, according to the White House. Stuart Anderson, director of the Iowa Department of Transportation, has said that funding will provide a revenue boost similar to when the state of Iowa raised its fuel tax in 2015. He said the funding boost represents a 25% increase in the first year and increases to a 35% boost by the fifth year. Exactly how much infrastructure money Sioux City might get is not yet known. City Economic Development Director Marty Doherty, who believes the city may likely have to apply for grants or work with the Iowa DOT, said he and Councilman Dan Moore recently advocated for several infrastructure projects before senators and congressmen from the region. Those projects included, just a moment, the South Bridge Interchange, a new Interstate 29 interchange which would serve the 3,000-acre South Bridge industrial area immediately south of Sioux Gateway Airport. A viaduct on 18th Street, which would stretch across railroad tracks in the Hoven Valley, thereby eliminating long wait times and increasing efficiency for railroad switching yards. Replacement of the conduit beneath Gordon Drive as part of the IDOT Gordon Drive Viaduct Replacement Project. Infrastructure can often drive economic growth, so we would certainly be looking carefully and looking closely at whatever funding opportunities there were, Doherty said. Scott said he is in favor of using infrastructure bill dollars to construct the viaduct at 18th Street and to make much-needed repairs in the city's downtown. Let's take care of that downtown section where the water main keeps breaking. It may mean repaving some streets and that type of stuff. That's where I'd hope we would use it. We can't keep flooding the basement of the Orpheum Theater every 2 years. Those types of projects would be a lot higher priority to get done, he said. Sherry Kuntz, special assistant to U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, said many types of infrastructure, from roads to drinking water to transit to broadband to cybersecurity, are funded through the bill. With the Missouri River, we've long wanted to have better snowpack monitoring in the plains during times of floods. That's been funded with this bill, she said. Moving forward with that through both NOAA as well as the Army Corps of Engineers will definitely help Sioux City and the rest of Iowa be more prepared for what water is coming through that reservoir system on the Missouri River and Upper Basin. Quint said the bill sets up new grant programs and also makes use of existing grant programs city officials are familiar with. She said Grassley's office will inform city and county officials about the funding opportunities that are available to them. Most of these aren't going back directly to the city. Most of them flow either through the state or are competitive, but there may be an opportunity or two that it goes back, she said. It's a big bill that has money that Iowa will definitely see, will definitely benefit, and so will Sioux City. Among Iowa's delegation, Democratic U.S. Representative Cindy Acne and Grassley voted for the funding. Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst and Republican U.S. Representatives Ashley Hinson, Marionette Miller Meeks, and Randy Feenstra voted against it. The bill, which had stalled in the democratically controlled House for months, passed the House 228 to 206 with just 13 Republican votes on November 6th. Feenstra, a first-term congressman for the 4th District, which includes Sioux City, referred to efforts by progressive Democrats to tie the infrastructure bill to Biden's larger Build Back Better package, which calls for as much as $2 trillion over 10 years on social programs and climate change measures. After 15-plus hours of watching the chaos and dysfunction of Democratic leadership unfold yesterday, I voted no on their effort to advance Build Back Broke, Feenster tweeted. After the House vote, they should spend less time fighting over how to waste your tax dollars and more time fixing supply chain issues and combating inflation. AGP eyes $71.5 million expansion. Dave Dreesen writes from Sergeant Bluff. Ag Processing Inc. is seeking over $1.4 million in state and local incentives to help finance a proposed $71.5 million expansion of its soybean crushing plant at Port Neal. State officials said the added capacity would allow the farmer-owned agribusiness to crush more beans grown in Siouxland. AGP plans to upgrade the Sergeant Bluff soybean processing facility to increase the sustainable crush rate, which would allow AGP members to sell production locally in an area that supply historically exceeds crush availability, according to a state report to the Iowa Economic Development Authority Board released Thursday. The IEDA board will meet in Des Moines Friday to consider AGP's application for a total aid package of $842,000, which would include $500,000 in investment tax credits and $342,000 in sales, service, and use taxes paid during the construction. The state assistance is contingent on a local government match from Woodbury County, according to state documents. The county supervisor scheduled a special meeting Friday to consider the co-op's request for property tax abatement of $578,242 over 5 years. The project, which is anticipated for completion in the fall of 2023, would create two new jobs, according to the state documents. The complex currently employs 128. The co-op's investment is projected to total $71.5 million, with $59.3 million in new machinery and equipment accounting for the largest expenditure. The IEDA staff report noted AGP's competitors in the bean processing industry include ADM, Cargill, and Bunge, all of which have a significant overall U.S. presence, as well as a presence in Iowa. AGP currently processes only a fraction of the soybeans grown in the region. Since production of soybeans has and is expected to continue to grow, AGP does not believe there will be a significant impact to other current users of these inputs, the report said. Just a moment. This is the latest major capital project at AGP's Sergeant Bluff complex in recent years. In 2017, the co-op constructed a $90 million vegetable oil refinery, which refines beans at the site, and also completed a $38 million expansion of its biodiesel plant. It was the fourth expansion of the Port Neal biodiesel plant, which was the nation's first commercial-scale biodiesel plant when it opened in 1996. The bean crushing facility was built by Farmland Industries in 1974 and purchased by AGP in 1983. One of the nation's largest cooperatives, AGP is owned by 149 local and regional cooperatives representing over 200,000 farmer producers across the U.S. It operates 10 soybean processing plants in Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, and South Dakota, as well as 4 soybean oil refineries and 3 biodiesel plants. Grassley defends yes vote on infrastructure. James Q. Lynch reports from Des Moines. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley continues to defend his yes vote on the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill, citing the needs to build out broadband, upgrade roads and bridges, and the broad support for the spending from Iowa agriculture, business, and local government. Grassley was one of just 19 Republican senators and the only Republican in Iowa's congressional delegation to back the package. From the time former President Donald Trump proposed a 4-year, $2 trillion infrastructure package, Grassley said he heard from various people, a lot of people, who were asking when we were going to get the infrastructure bill done. We didn't get it done, he told reporters Wednesday. So when the Biden administration proposed an infrastructure package for half that much spread over 8 years, I voted for it because of what I'd been hearing from Iowans. Those Iowans included corn, soybean, pork, and cattle commodity groups, agricultural retailers, airport operators, truckers, chambers of commerce from Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, Waterloo, Sioux City, Council Bluffs, Dubuque, and others, the Iowa League of Cities, and Iowa State Association of Counties. While there were many reasons to support the bipartisan infrastructure package, one of the keys was a minimum of $100 million for broadband. Grassley said, he wants to make sure those funds are used in unserved and underserved areas of Iowa. The broadband funds, he said, are on top of existing funds from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Federal Communications Commission. Regardless of the source, I'm going to want to make sure that the money doesn't go to places where they have good services already. Another key was the $3.4 billion for highways and an additional $431 million to help rebuild the 23% of Iowa's bridges that are structurally deficient. That means they are unsafe or a little unsafe, he said, and I've been hearing from county supervisors and the Iowa Department of Transportation how bad we are. We are the worst of the 50 states. He also pointed out that much of the funding in the bipartisan infrastructure package would have been appropriated through the motor fuel tax formula. Even without the bill, we would be spending half of that normally based on the formula in place since the development of the interstate highway system, Grassley said. Other highlights of the bill for Iowa are $638 million to upgrade water lines and replace lead pipes, $305 million over 5 years to improve public transportation, and $120 million for airport modernization. The bipartisan infrastructure package is a significant investment in Iowa's future, Grassley said. I hope I'm representing the people and the needs of Iowans by the yes vote, he said. The bottom line is that I'm going to make sure Iowans reap the benefits of this infrastructure investment. Hat rack art outside Sioux City Hall to be replaced. Dolly A. Butts reports from Sioux City. The Sculpt Siouxland Board has decided to replace a hat rack bolted to the sidewalk outside Sioux City Hall. Hang Your Hat 3, an example of ready-made art from Ken Peterson, had become rusty and one of its hooks had broken off. Since the damage to the third version of the hat rack is irreparable, Sioux City Art Center Director Todd Behrens said Thursday that the board is going to find a replacement coat rack as soon as possible, which would be the fourth of its kind. Behrens told the Journal Wednesday that the board was moving toward removing the rack from its collection, but an official decision had not yet been made about the rack's future. Hang Your Hat 3 is currently in storage at the Art Center. The rack matches donors of winter coats and other clothing with local residents living on the street. From the start, Peterson said he envisioned the rack as sort of a thrift store, operating outside the parameters of a traditional brick-and-mortar store. He said the informal exchange quickly became a hit with those living on the fringes of society, who are uncomfortable entering a store or seeking social services. And now these local news briefs. From Lamars, Iowa, Lamars man sentenced to prison for arson. A man who set a fire in a Lamars apartment complex was sentenced Thursday to 14 years in prison. Patrick Van Noort, 25, entered a written plea of guilty Wednesday in Plymouth County District Court to second-degree arson, second offense operating while intoxicated, making a false police report, and driving while license revoked. Van Noort pleaded guilty as part of a plea agreement in which the arson charge was reduced from first degree to second degree. A charge of second-degree criminal mischief was dismissed. District Judge Jeffrey Neary followed the terms of the plea agreement and sentenced Van Noort to 10 years in prison on the arson charge and 4 years total on the remaining three charges, which stemmed from three separate arrests in June, July, and August. Van Noort was ordered to pay $4,555 in restitution for the fire damage. Van Noort stuffed paper and bedding into a toaster appliance, causing a fire in his girlfriend's apartment at 310 12th Street Southeast on April 16th. She told police that Van Noort had come home intoxicated earlier in the evening, and they had an argument before she left. A friend later called the woman to tell her that Van Noort was removing items from the apartment and had left. When the friend checked the apartment, she found heavy smoke coming from the bedroom. COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations increase from Sioux City. COVID-19-related deaths and hospitalizations, as well as new cases of the virus, increased in Woodbury County last week. The county reported 290 positive cases for the week beginning November 8th, up from 269 the week before, according to the latest weekly report from Siouxland District Health Department. The number of people in Sioux City's two hospitals with COVID-19 rose from 37 the week of November 1st to 39 last week. 25 of those hospitalizations are due to the virus, according to the report. During that period, Woodbury County also tallied two more COVID-19-related deaths, bringing its total to 256. Hospitalizations and deaths lag reported cases. The 14-day positivity rate declined from 11% to 10.3%. Health officials have said anything above 5% is a concern. As of the week of November 8th, 47.3% of county residents had completed single or two-dose vaccinations, up from 47.1% the previous week. With great access to testing, vaccines, and early treatment options, we all have the tools we need to protect ourselves and our families, District Health said in a Facebook post. Sioux City man faces federal child sex charge from Sioux City. A Sioux City man has been indicted in federal court on a charge of sexually abusing an 11-year-old girl. Juan Pablo Hernandez, 44, pleaded not guilty November 5th in U.S. District Court in Sioux City to one count of aggravated sexual abuse of a child. His trial was scheduled for January 3rd. Pablo Hernandez was arrested September 24th and charged in Woodbury County District Court with two counts each of second-degree sexual abuse, indecent contact with a child, and lascivious acts with a child. The case was dismissed after Pablo Hernandez was indicted in federal court. According to court documents, Pablo Hernandez had sex with the girl on two occasions between July 15th and September 15th in an apartment in the 1600 block of Douglas Street. During an interview with police, Pablo Hernandez admitted to having sex and other sexual contact with the girl, court documents said. One hurt in downtown Sioux City accident. A driver who failed to stop for a red light was injured Thursday in a two-car collision at a downtown Sioux City intersection. Sioux City police and rescue personnel responded to the accident at 7:24 a.m. at 6th and Nebraska Streets. Upon arrival, emergency responders found a Nissan Armada SUV on its side and the driver unresponsive. The driver, an adult female, was extricated from the vehicle and taken to Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center for treatment of minor injuries. According to police, the woman was westbound in the center lane on 6th Street and failed to stop for the red light. The SUV entered the intersection and was struck by a Chrysler Pacifica minivan that was northbound on Nebraska Street. The collision caused the SUV to flip onto its side. The driver of the minivan was not injured. Police are investigating whether the SUV driver had a medical issue that contributed to the accident. Police have ruled out intoxication as a factor. No charges have been filed, pending the outcome of the investigation. And finally, man pleads not guilty to federal charges. From Sioux Falls, a Yankton, South Dakota man has been indicted on charges of receiving and distributing child pornography. Dylan Steffen, 29, pleaded not guilty Wednesday in U.S. District Court in Sioux Falls to two counts of receipt and distribution of child pornography. If found guilty, he faces up to 20 years in prison. The indictment charges Steffen with receiving and distributing and attempting to receive and distribute child pornography in January and March. Oh, those views. Tour of Homes offers a holiday look downtown. Bruce R. Miller reports. What do this year's Tour of Homes residences have in common? Great views. Located in downtown Sioux City, the five homes are situated in upper floors of historic buildings. Two are in the Warrior Apartments. One is in Bluebird Flats. One is in Copper Flats. And one is in the condos on 4th and Jackson Streets. Look out the windows, and you'll see a downtown district you never knew. It's dramatically good. The decorating is pretty memorable as well. Erica Hansen, for example, uses pastels and some decidedly 70s colors to make her place in Copper Flats stand out. Amy McFarlane and Julie Kellen have decked their spot in the Stifel Nicholas building with classic consignment items. Dory Sexton and Marie Hoffmeyer, who have two apartments in the Warrior Apartments, have decorated with an eye for consistent theming throughout. Lisa Kelleher has given her place in the Bluebird Flats a retro feel. What stood out? Two apartments had distinctly decorated areas for the family pet. Trees are still big and carried throughout each room. Windowscapes are important, particularly with those views. Lucite is big. Family heirlooms, like a silver service set, can be brought out for the holidays and put anywhere, like a bedroom. Games should be an important part of the season. No spot should be left unturned. Jenny Davis, a frequent designer in the tour, has also provided ideas for those common areas you might not think about decorating. Decorating tips abound, but this year there's a twist. If you see something you like, you can take a photo of it, and in a pop-up shop at the end of the tour, you can purchase what's available. Sponsored by Big Brothers Big Sisters of Siouxland, this year's tour will get you into places that may have piqued your curiosity. These downtown spots might even encourage you to become part of the community. The tour runs November 18th through 20th, and it leaves from the Warrior Hotel. For more information, call 712-239-9890. And in other Iowa news, strikers return to work. Dear UAW lauded a successful contract, reported by Kara Smith from the Quad City Times. About 10,100 United Auto Workers left the picket lines and returned to work Thursday morning, ending a five-week-long strike. International Union, United Automobile, Aerospace and Agricultural Implement Workers of America resumed work at 12 John Deere facilities across Iowa, Illinois, and Kansas after voting to approve a third and final offer from the Moline-based agricultural manufacturer. Other than minor changes to Deere's continuous improvement pay program, the company's third offer presented the same benefits as a second agreement turned away November 2nd by a 55% to 45% vote, with support from some Quad City Union locals, but rejection from shops in Waterloo and Dubuque. This time, union members approved the deal overwhelmingly, 61% to 39%. Chuck Browning, vice president of the UAW, said in a statement that the union members who were on strike supported a movement across the nation. Our members' courageous willingness to strike in order to attain a better standard of living and a more secure retirement resulted in a groundbreaking contract and sets a new standard for workers not only within the UAW, but throughout the country, Browning said. The sacrifice and solidarity displayed by our John Deere members, combined with the determination of their negotiators, made this accomplishment possible. John May, CEO for Deere, said in a statement that, together with their workers, Deere and Company's future is bright. Through our new collective bargaining agreements, we're giving employees the opportunity to earn wages and benefits that are the best in our industries and are groundbreaking in many ways, May said. We have faith that in return, our employees will find new and better ways to improve our competitiveness and transform the way our customers do their work. Tensions are still high within the union as members return to their Quad Cities John Deere plants Wednesday night and Thursday morning, according to workers. I made a comment, it was a good contract. I thought it was okay, said a worker from John Deere Parts Distribution, John Deere Parts Distribution Center in Milan. And there was some grumbling, you could tell. Workers reported some confusion in how to return for work. Some employees reported for third shifts just hours after the vote. Others said the announcement came without enough notice and instead planned to return to work Thursday or Friday. There's a lot of people who didn't show up to work Thursday, said a worker from Davenport Works. I figured I'd show up, and if I wasn't supposed to be here, I wouldn't be able to badge in. At the plant in Milan, one worker said that only half of UAW employees showed up to their shift on Thursday morning. Workers scheduled for the third shift had the option to come in, but were not required to, according to the employee. However, it was mandatory that workers show up for their shifts Thursday and Friday morning. It will be better tomorrow, the worker said. They will start writing them up. Workers also reported that supply chain issues were still causing delays in production, a problem that existed prior to the strike. A spokesperson for Deere said the company won't be commenting on the day-to-day operations at our factories or units. Shareholders will learn more about how the strike has affected the company next week during Deere's quarterly earnings call this Wednesday, said Jen Hartman, a Deere spokesperson. We've had to overcome a number of challenges this year, including supply chain disruptions and the strike, she said. The ratified agreement means our highly skilled employees are back to work, building the finest products in our industries. We will continue to do all it takes to meet the needs of our customers. The final agreement triggered immediate 10% raises and kept the 5% raises that were in the third and fifth years of the six-year deal, plus 3% lump sum payments in the second, fourth, and sixth years of the deal. The offer would also provide an $8,500 ratification bonus, preserve a pension option for new employees, make workers eligible for health insurance sooner, and maintain their no-premium health insurance coverage. Paul Iverson, a labor expert at the University of Iowa, said that an increase in wages and benefits have the markers of a successful strike. By standing up for themselves, workers stood up for future generations, according to Iverson. They definitely got a better contract than they could have without the strike, and they remain unified as they drove a strike, Iverson said. It's also a victory for the communities where your workers work, because their support was vital to the success of the strike. They tend to retain good jobs within their community, and the pay workers receive is going to be circulating throughout the economy, making a more robust economy in those communities. One worker from Deere's Milan plant, who voted yes on both the second and third agreements, said workers accepted the best deal they were going to get. "I just think if we had stayed out longer, we would have lost more money," the worker said. "There's always more money that could have been given. We know that. We know the company didn't want to give more, but I could live with what we got." Once again, you are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, November 19th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Services for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Richard E. "Rich" Smith, 74, of Ida Grove, passed away on Thursday, November 11th, at a local hospital. Celebration of life service will be held at 4 p.m., with a visitation held prior to the service from 2 to 4 p.m. on Monday at the Skate Palace of Ida Grove. Pastor Tyler Parson will officiate. Military rites will be conducted by the McNamara Moore Post, number 61, of the American Legion of Ida Grove. The Christensen Van Houten Funeral Home of Ida Grove is in charge of the funeral arrangements. Condolences may be sent online at christensenvanhouten.com. Richard "Rich" Smith, the son of Claude and Wanda Higer Smith, was born on September 22, 1947, in Superior, Nebraska. He grew up in Bronson, Iowa, and received his high school degree in 1965 from Lawton Bronson High School, eventually earning his bachelor's degree from the University of South Dakota. After high school, Rich enlisted into the Iowa Army National Guard. His unit was called into active duty, and Rich was stationed at Fort Carson, Colorado. He was deployed to Vietnam in 1968, where he served as infantry officer. When he returned from Vietnam, he served as liaison officer in Sioux City, followed by company commander of the Sheldon unit. He honorably served his country and received the Silver Star for gallantry in action, the Bronze Star for outstandingly meritorious service, and two Purple Hearts for wounded in action. Upon his honorable discharge from active duty, Rich returned home to Sioux City, where he married his beloved wife of 51 years, Sue M. Kafka, on May 9, 1970. In 1971, they were blessed with the birth of their first son, Sean, followed by their second son, Ryan, in 1981. Rich accepted a position with Gomeco in 1975, and the family relocated to Ida Grove, Iowa. His 46-year career included Vice President of Administration and Finance at Gomeco, CEO of Bobbily Hydraulics in Lawrence, Iowa, and a Director of Gomeco International Limited in London, England. The Godberson family provided a long and solid career path that Rich never thought of as work. He cherished his time at Gomeco, which gave him the opportunity to forge many lifelong friendships. During his high school years, Rich enjoyed sports and was particularly fond of baseball. In 1964, he was part of the high school team that claimed the state baseball championship title for Lawton. During his time at University of South Dakota, Rich earned athletic letters in baseball. His love for the game would continue into his 20s and 30s, with him playing on semi-pro fast-pitch softball teams, including Clear Lake Buttertop in the late 70s and Sioux City Pen Corp in the early 80s. During his softball career, he earned numerous MVP and All-Tournament team accolades, including being named to an All-Decade team. In 1985, he was awarded First Team All-American by the ASA, which offered the opportunity to play in the Pan American Games and earned a berth to the 1986 Olympic Sports Festival in Raleigh, North Carolina. His 17-year career culminated with a 1992 induction into the Iowa Fast Pitch Softball Hall of Fame. Rich was an avid outdoorsman. His love for the outdoors included a passion for hunting upland game birds over hunting dogs. He also took many opportunities to hunt big game and waterfowl. Later in life, Rich found his peace, whether it was lake fishing, deep sea fishing, or a local pond with rod in hand. Rich's passion for conservation efforts and the great outdoors would lead him to spearhead and start the Ida County chapter of Pheasants Forever, serving as president of the county chapter for 25 years. In 2011, he was inducted into the Pheasants Forever Hall of Fame. Throughout his life, Rich had the opportunity to mentor and inspire numerous young men and youth in Ida County on baseball, hunting, fishing, and conservation efforts. He was a lifelong Yankees fan, loyal Chicago Bears fan, and loved cheering on the Iowa Hawkeyes. He treasured spending time with his two sons, and especially the grandkids who called him Grandpop. Dave D. Harvey, 69, of rural Humboldt, South Dakota, died Thursday, November 4th. A celebration of life will be held at The Social at 301 South Thompson Avenue in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, from 1 to 5 p.m. on Saturday. Arrangements are with Hartquist Funeral Home in Luverne, Minnesota. To send condolences and sign an online registry, visit HartquistFuneral.com. Dave is survived by his four children, Tracy and her husband Todd Bonney of Dakota Dunes, Terry Harvey of Sioux City, Scott Harvey of Sioux Falls, and Sherry Harvey of Sergeant Bluff. Norman H. Tim, 89, of Omaha and formerly of Ute, entered into eternal rest on Monday, November 15th, at the Omaha VA Medical Center of Omaha. Services will be held at 11 a.m., with visitation held prior to the service, from 10 to 11 a.m. on Saturday at St. Paul Lutheran Church of Ute. Reverend Nathan Peitsch, that's P-E-I-T-S-C-H, will officiate. Committal services with military rites will follow in the St. Clair Township Cemetery of Ute. A Facebook Live broadcast of the service will be available on the church's Facebook page. The Armstrong Van Houten Funeral Home of Ute is in charge of the funeral arrangements. Condolences may be sent online at armstrongfuneral.com. Norman Henry Tim, son of Henry A. and Edna A. Keepy Tim, was born on April 16, 1932, in Charter Oak Township, Crawford County, Iowa. Norman was baptized and confirmed at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Ute. He graduated from Ute High School with the class of 1950. He married the love of his life, Donna L. Jacobs, on June 8, 1952, at the St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Ute. To this union, five daughters were born: Deb, Denise, Deanna, Danette, and Dodie. Following graduation, he served in the United States Armed Forces. After returning home, he operated the Skelly gas station in Ute until he purchased the business he ran for 40 years, Norman Tim Sales. After retiring from the candy business, he worked for the Burgess Memorial Hospital in Onawa, Iowa. Norman and Donna enjoyed going to auction sales and finding antiques. He was a lifelong member of the VFW. He was a devoted husband and father who especially enjoyed spending time with his grandchildren. He also loved his pugs, Fonzie and Bert. He will be dearly missed by not only his family, but also his many friends, including those at Trinity Village in Omaha. Helen Elizabeth Main, M-E-I-N-E, 88, of Sioux City, passed away Wednesday, November 17th, at her home. Service will be held at 11:30 a.m. on Saturday at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel, with Reverend Roger Madden officiating. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to service time. The service will be live streamed at, goodness, I'm not going to attempt to read that. A private interment will follow at Logan Park Cemetery. Online condolences can be expressed at meyerbroschapels.com. Hopefully you can find the website for that live streaming on that website. Helen was born December 27, 1932, in Des Moines, Iowa, the daughter of Raymond and Lorabelle Andrews Robertson. She was raised on a farm outside Des Moines and graduated from Valley High School. Following graduation, she enrolled in University of Iowa in Iowa City, where she met her future husband, Dean Miney. The couple married on August 24, 1952. To this union, four children were born. After marriage, the couple moved to Sioux City. Helen was a homemaker and worked for many charities. In 1982, she graduated from Briarcliff University with her bachelor's degree, majoring in psychology and minoring in music. Helen was a devoted member of First United Methodist Church. She played bells and sang in the church choir for many years. She was a member of La Serotoma and was very involved with PEO. She was instrumental in pioneering a program to screen children for their eyesight in kindergarten. She was an instructor for the Nationwide Bible Study Fellowship Group. Helen enjoyed music and playing piano. She also enjoyed playing golf and tennis. Clifford Cliff Lang, 73, of North Sioux City, died Tuesday, November 16th. Services will be November 22nd at 10:30 a.m. at Trinity Lutheran Church, LCMS, in Hinton, Iowa. Burial will be following the service at Trinity Lutheran Cemetery. Visitation will be November 21st from 5 to 7 p.m. at Rexwinkle Funeral Home in Lamars, Iowa, and resume 1 hour prior to service time at the church. And finally, Susan E. Cameron, 72, of Hinton, Iowa, died Wednesday, November 17th. Arrangements are pending with Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. And now these local sports stories. It Wasn't Meant to Be, written by Shane Lance from Cedar Falls. The West Sioux High School football team came up short Thursday evening in the Class 1A state title game, but still put up quite a fight against mighty number 1, Van Meter. The Falcons fell to the Bulldogs 17-14 as Van Meter ran out the clock with a trio of first downs on the final drive of the game. West Sioux made the game a nail-biter with 4 minutes 25 seconds left on the clock when Falcons quarterback Dylan Wickens heaved an arching pass toward the end zone. Junior wide receiver Brady Lynott battled his defender and came down with the ball for a touchdown, pulling the Falcons within 3 points. But on the next drive, Van Meter managed 3 first downs, the final one a 16-yard pass from senior quarterback Jack Pettit to senior wide receiver Gannon Archer at the 26 to steal the victory. With the win, Van Meter clinched the second state title in program history, while West Sioux fell short of its third. While the Falcons walked away without a championship trophy, they managed to outgain the favored Bulldogs in total offense by 17 yards. Van Meter came into the game with the second most touchdowns and fourth most all-purpose yards in Class 1A, but West Sioux held the Bulldogs to just 252 total yards, 111 through the air and 141 on the ground. But an early blocked punt and a pair of costly West Sioux turnovers gave Van Meter a boost, and the Bulldogs came out with the trophy. Our defense balled out all game long against a really good Van Meter offense and a really good running attack, West Sioux coach Ryan Schweizow said. It just wasn't meant to be. We just had the turnovers at untimely points. Just a moment. On offense, West Sioux managed 269 total yards, led by junior quarterback Dylan Wickens with 139 passing yards, and junior running back Carter Boltman, who had 79 yards on the ground. Van Meter struck first, thanks to a blocked punt at the 18-yard line from sophomore John Braun. The Bulldogs then took 3 plays to score, with Jack Pettit hitting senior Chris Schreck in the end zone for a 6-0 lead. Van Meter kicker Katie Lindsay split the uprights on the ensuing point after attempt to become the first goal in state history to score a point at a state title game. The Bulldogs scored again early in the second quarter as a defenseless player penalty on West Sioux gave Van Meter a first and goal at the 7. 2 plays later, Van Meter quarterback ran it from the 1 yard line for a 14-0 Bulldogs advantage. West Sioux's turn finally came with 20 seconds left in the first half, when the Falcons finished off a 62-yard drive with a touchdown. Wiggins hits senior Levi Koopmans on third down for a 16-yard pass to put the Falcons at the 1 yard line, and the Bulldogs stuffed Carter Bolteman twice at the line. On third down, senior Blake Van Balaguyen took the handoff from Wiggins on the right side and then dumped the ball off to Bolteman in the end zone for a touchdown. At halftime, Van Meter led West Sioux 14-7, despite the Falcons holding a 151-141 advantage in total yards. Midway through the third quarter, the Falcons went 62 yards on 12 plays to give themselves a first and 10 at the 17-yard line. Bolteman threw the ball for a yard, and Wiggins threw back-to-back incompletions to make it a Falcons 4th and 9 at the 16. The Falcons went for it, but Wiggins was sacked in the backfield by Bulldog senior Casey Trudeau, and Van Meter took the ball back on downs. Van Meter then took the ball back to the 11 before West Sioux stopped the drive on a sack, but Bulldogs kicker Katie Lindsay successfully converted a 27-yard field goal to extend Van Meter's lead to 17-7. West Sioux responded with a touchdown drive on their next possession. After going 27 yards on 7 plays, the Falcons faced 2nd and 7 at the 32. Wiggins then uncorked a 32-yard pass that Linett caught in traffic to pull the score within 3. Van Meter clinched the win minutes later with a 53-yard drive that ended in victory formation at the 26, and the Bulldogs sideline swarmed the turf in celebration. Wiggins finished the night 13 of 24, passing for 73 yards, while Van Balaguyen finished with the team's only touchdown pass. Carter Bolteman had a team-high 79 rushing yards, while junior Brady Linett had a team-high 5 catches for 69 yards and 1 score. The Falcons end the season with an 11-2 overall record and will graduate 11 seniors before they take the field for the 2022 season. "It was definitely a battle," Wiggins said. "I've got to give a lot of credit to the seniors. They were there from the beginning. They brought us here and they showed us what to do. They were definitely a big part of this year and our success. I've got to give a lot of credit to them." Schweisnow has coached this year's senior class since they were 8 years old, and he feels a special bond with the group, which includes his son, senior Aiden Schweisau. "I love these guys like they're my own kids," Schweisau said. "I get on them a lot of times like they're my own kids too, but I love these guys. I heard a coach say once, the greatest two things you can be called in your life is coach and dad. I've been fortunate enough to do that with both on the same day. That's pretty special for me to think." Wildcats battle stacked Jaguars. Shane Lance reports from Cedar Falls, Iowa. For one team, this is the first state title game in program history. For the other, championship game appearances come around every so often. For both, this is the biggest game in years. The West Lyon High School football team on Friday will play Southeast Valley for the program's second state title in the past 3 years. West Lyon comes into the game on a 9-game winning streak, with its most recent victory being a thrilling 20-14 overtime win over Williamsburg. Senior quarterback Jackson Meyer was the difference maker with 3 rushing touchdowns, including a 5-yarder in overtime to end the game and send the team to the title game. The Jaguars, meanwhile, have battled their way to an 11-1 record and are about to play on the big stage for the very first time after beating Waukon in the Class 2A state semifinals 50-14. Now the Wildcats will have to go up against a fearsome Southeast Valley squad in a fight for the state championship. On offense, Southeast Valley ranks first in Class 2A in total touchdowns and offensive yards, second in all-purpose yards, and third in passing touchdowns, while the defense is tops in 2A in total sacks and is tied for first in fumble recoveries. The Jaguars' offense leans run, with 493 rushes for 2,684 yards, but the team also has a pair of wide receivers with over 650 receiving yards this season, and have a total of 25 touchdowns and 2,207 total yards through the air. They are stacked, West Lyon head coach Jay Roseboom said. They have great athletes that play both sides of the ball. Offensively, they have the ability to run and throw the ball equally well. Stats-wise, they run the ball more than they throw the ball, but whenever they throw the ball, they are very efficient at it. Southeast Valley ranks 5th in Class 2A in both passing yards and rushing yards at 2,207 and 2,684, respectively, thanks in large part to the play of standout senior Colson Cruz. Cruz is the definition of a dual-threat quarterback, with a 2A best 43 total touchdowns on the season, 25 of them passing and 18 rushing. Cruz has 2,184 passing yards this season, good for 5th in Class 2A, and also has 1,504 rushing yards, good for 3rd overall. Elsewhere on offense, senior running back Leith Munch has 21 rushing touchdowns, 3rd most in Class 2A, while Eli Johnson and Trey Fisher are 3rd and 4th with respective yards per catch averages of 23 and 22.9. Their quarterback has a big arm and can make every throw, Roseboom said. He has really fast receivers, they have a really good running game, and a great offensive line. There is a reason they are on the state championship game. On defense, Southeast Valley has a 2A high, 38.5 sacks on the season, with seniors Aaron Graves and Colton Brandt leading the way with 7.5 apiece, and junior Justin Losecki close behind with 7. Brandt has a team-high 3 fumble recoveries this season, as the Jaguars lead their class with 16, along with 7 interceptions. Defensively, they just don't give up very many yards, Roseboom said. They put the big Graves kid over the middle on the nose, and it makes it really hard to run out. They just have really big athletes on both sides of the ball. But West Lyon has plenty of playmakers, too. The Wildcats lead the state in total rushing attempts, ranked 3rd in Class 2A in both rushing touchdowns and rushing yards, while the Wildcats' defense has picked off 19 passes and scored 5 defensive touchdowns, both good for 2nd in 2A. Meyer leads the Wildcats with 857 rushing yards this season and 14 touchdowns, while senior Hunter Jacobson has 757 and 7 TDs. After last week's tense win, which Meyer said was the first overtime game he can remember ever playing, the Wildcats go into this week knowing that they have the ability to win under pressure. This is a team that has managed to push through adversity throughout the season, according to Roseboom. They started the season off 1-2, with one of those losses being a 40-7 blowout defeat to Estherville Lincoln Central back on September 3rd. 11 weeks later, West Lyon is on the verge of adding even more hardware to its already crowded trophy case. The Wildcats' 6th state title is on the line. This is a team that has hung together, Roseboom said. They've had to face adversity several times. Get knocked down, get back up again. They just hang together, never panic, and play hard for each other. It was a fun win, and I think it proves we can play for 4 quarters and an overtime period. We live to fight another day. West Lyon and Southeast Valley will play for the Class 2A title in the UNI Dome on Friday at 10 a.m. And in GPAC men's basketball, first half surge lifts Mustangs, Barry Poe reports from Sioux City. This head coaching stuff is working out just fine so far for Trent Miller. Miller, a former Morningside University player and assistant coach, took over the head men's basketball duties from Jim Sykes, now the school's athletic director. The Mustangs are off to a 5-1 start under Miller and improved to 2-0 in the Great Plains Athletic Conference with an 88-75 triumph over Dort on Wednesday at the Rosenvierdorn Sports Center. The transition has gone as well as I think it can be just because I've been surrounded by the rest of the staff, which has been tremendous making the transition with me, Miller said. Coach Sykes being just up the hill in the AD's office has been a huge resource that I lean on, and having a lot of guys return has been wonderful. I'm really spoiled in year one. All-conference performers Trey Brown and Zach Imig decided to come back after players were granted an extra season of eligibility because of COVID-19. The Mustangs also returned junior Will Potterbaum and sophomore Aiden Vanderloo to the starting lineup, as well as a number of key reserves. Vanderloo, a former East High standout, finished with 16 points and Potterbaum chipped in 14. Brown, meanwhile, had a double-double with 10 points and 13 rebounds, and Joey Scoff came off the bench to tally a team-high 17 points. Scoff was a major contributor to a first-half surge that ultimately decided the outcome. Morningside snapped a 9-9 tie with 12 unanswered points, opening up some breathing room midway through the first half. The Mustangs used the spree to take a commanding 44-26 halftime lead and eventually led by as many as 23 points. Dort cut it to 11 points midway through the second half, but Vanderloo scored 7 points during another 8-0 Morningside run. "We did a good job at times moving the ball from side to side. Got some good looks," Vanderloo said. "But again, there were times that we weren't. Credit to Dort, they completed all we wanted to down the stretch. They got it back to 11 at the blink of an eye. We're going to take the win all night, but we have things to work on." Pardon me. Morningside shot 53% from the field and held a commanding 43-25 rebound advantage. The Mustangs made 16 free throws compared to 4 for Dort. "They're so dynamic offensively, averaging 88 points a game," Miller said. "So we were thinking if we just stay true to our defense and hopefully when they do miss, we can capitalize. We got them to miss a few shots and got some transition baskets in that first half run. I thought we got our hands on some balls in the passing lanes that allowed us to run. Our defense usually dictates our offense. Dort is a young but talented team that had won 6 in a row since a season opening loss. They have a real good team, and so do we. We're just a little young right now," Dort coach Brian Van Haften said. "You could see our guards struggled every once in a while, and sometimes you see them make great plays. We just have to diminish some of the plays that make us struggle a little bit. But we'll keep getting better as the year goes on." Junior Cade Bleeker paced the defenders with 18 points. Sophomore guard Bryce Kopuk and freshman Luke Rankin combined for 27 points. And finally, Mustangs play best game. Barry Poe reports from Sioux City. After a somewhat sluggish start to the season, the Morningside women's basketball team appears to have righted the ship. The Mustangs, ranked number 6 in NAIA women's basketball, lost their first 2 games, but have since won 3 in a row, including an 84-65 rout of Dort Wednesday at Alley Gym. "We've kind of struggled the first 4 games, haven't played well defensively, so I was obviously concerned," Morningside coach Jamie Sale said. "Dort was playing real well, and I didn't know if we would be able to stop them inside. We did a really good job of executing our game plan, doubling when we needed to. We've really been getting out rebounded, but we did a good job on the boards this time. It was by far our best game." Morningside, now 2-0 in the Great Plains Athletic Conference, blitzed the visiting defenders early. The Mustangs hit their first 4 shots and scored on 5 of their first 6 possessions, zipping to a 12-2 lead. Dort never really recovered from that. By the time the first quarter ended, it was 27-13, and Morningside had doubled the score by intermission, leading 46-23. Then, to end any hopes Dort had, the Mustangs scored on 6 of their first 7 possessions in the third quarter. "They just came out with such great energy and had us on our heels right from the start," Dort coach Bill Harmson said. "That's kind of been the thing with our team. We've been able to do that with everybody. I thought we were ready to go, but man, giving up 27 points in the first quarter against a great team on the road, that's going to be a tough haul to get back into it." 4 of Morningside's starters reached double figures, and the other, McKenna Sims, contributed 9 points, 9 rebounds, and 7 assists. Chloe Lofstrom, a fast-improving sophomore post, registered a double-double with 15 points and 11 rebounds. "I'm definitely a lot more confident than I was last year," said the 6-footer from Armstrong, Iowa. "I made the decision to stay here over the summer, and I think that really helped me mentally. I think that was my biggest thing last year. The game was a big jump from high school to college. Mentally, I just wasn't there last year, but I'm catching up now." Lofstrom was 6-for-10 for the field, nailing both of her 3-point attempts. Taylor Rodenberg paced the Mustangs with 19 points, while Sierra Mitchell added 17 points and Sophia Peppers 13 points. Morningside was a perfect 15 of 15 from the free throw line and 10 for 29 from beyond the arc, which has been moved back a bit this season. "That's the best we've moved the ball and played together," Sale said. "We got into too many isolation-type situations the first four games. In the first half, we had 16 baskets and 13 of them had assists, so we really moved the ball well and played together." Dort, which is at 5-2 or 0-1, had won four in a row, including a victory over fourth-ranked Marion, Ohio, last week. The defenders, though, shot just 39% from the floor and were out-rebounded 43-32. Bailey Beckman was the only Dort player in double figures with 17 points. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, November 19th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.